members of the Commonwealth Club, distinguished visitors and guests, at the close of the European War, a noted foreign newspaper correspondent in San Francisco told me that he would like to see how we celebrated VE Day. He came first to Stanford University. The radio was telling of the utter delight and joy of people in Britain and Russia. And to this man's surprise, he saw 2,000 or 3,000 students streaming through the Memorial Court to a service for VE Day with no great signs of joy, no visible demonstration, looking happy and pleasant, but for the most part quiet. He watched a service of the students, which was restrained, a little on the sober side, then on to San Francisco, and by that time we were hearing of these great demonstrations in other places in the world, people marching, singing, and here in San Francisco he was struck by this same quality of quiet and not sadness, not gloom. And this was very difficult for him to understand. The radio by this time was telling all of us the war isn't over, don't think this is the end, exhorting the people through the press to recall the job was half done. But on the Pacific coast, we didn't need that lesson. We understood the unrestrained joy of the British once more to have their lights on, feel safe after dark, families to feel secure when their children went to school. We understood and sympathized with our allies, the Russians, who had suffered so much and had paid such a heavy price for their victory. But those of us living on Pacific shores tempered our joy at the end of one terrible war with a realization of what still faced us as we looked toward the west. Our bay was full of ships. Our trains were bearing wounded to our hospitals nearby. Our boys were dying every minute on the Pacific Islands. And then, too, we were reminded of the years of suffering and fighting and sacrifice of the Chinese, who still had a terrible enemy on their lands and who still had heavy sacrifices to make. Beyond this, I think our San Francisco mood was explained by the fact that meeting here were many of the nations of the world seeking means to curb and limit power for the benefit of civilized peoples, seeking means of reducing at least the incidence of war. Two, in San Francisco, we had a vivid realization of how completely we were in the hands of the leaders of these assembled nations, how much our own fortunes and those of our children rested upon the judgment, the knowledge, the tolerance of the men here representing their countries. Our speaker today is one of these distinguished men. He spent 7 years at Columbia, first as an undergraduate, then getting his master's degree, and later his PhD. We find him representing his nation at the peace conference in Paris. We find him serving with distinction in Geneva, first in the assembly, then with the council, and later in 1937 as president of the council. We find him in 1922 representing his nation in Washington at the Armament Limitations Conference. And again, he turns up in Britain at the 1933 Economic Conference. And so, without reciting the long list of accomplishments of this brilliant scholar, diplomat, Chinese patriot, I take great pleasure in introducing him to you in order that we may get another impression of our allies and the people assembled here, and get further reassurance, as indeed we've had it through these last 3 weeks, as to the quality of mind and experience and intention of the men here gathered. It is with the greatest pleasure that I introduce Dr. Wellington Ku to the Commonwealth Club, representative of a nation that has suffered long and has much suffering yet to endure. Dr. Ku.
Mr. Chairman, the President of the Club, ladies and gentlemen, before I start to speak on the subject which I proposed to address you upon, China and the conference, may I say how much I appreciate the invitation of the Commonwealth Club of California to meet you and to share in the hospitality of this great organization. I recall in my early days when I was a student in a class on English history, one of my classmates was asked by our teacher, what are the principal provisions of the Magna Carta? The boy blurted out saying, bread, butter, and cheese. In these days of food rationing, one enjoys all the more the splendid hospitality and also the excellent cooking provided today. I want to say how much I consider this opportunity and how much I deem it as a great honor and privilege to speak before this distinguished assembly of men and women, members and friends of the Commonwealth Club, and through you to the people of the West Coast of these United States. You are the pioneers and builders of American civilization. In you is embodied the fine spirit of enterprise and initiative. In you is personified the spirit of good neighborliness. Much though have I traveled around the world, I can think of no community that is more friendly and hospitable. The other day as I stood on the Knob Hill, overlooking this great and growing metropolis, the magnificent Golden Gate Bridge, and the blue waters beyond, I wish to tell you, I fell in love with San Francisco. And ladies and gentlemen, this wasn't love at second sight either. The statesmen at Yalta could not have chosen a better city in which to hold the first full dress United Nations conference. San Francisco, indeed, is the pride of America and the envy of the world. The United States and the Republic of China have always been good neighbors. I say we are neighbors because certainly we are not distant strangers. The Pacific is no longer a barrier separating the American and the Chinese people. It has become a bridge, a connecting link between us. The relations between the United States and the Republic of China have always been characterized by friendliness. The reasons are not far to seek. We Chinese have an infinite faith in your goodwill, and you Americans have great confidence in our traditions and potentialities. I know you will never betray our faith in you, and I hope we shall never undermine your confidence in us. China and her problems must be viewed and appraised in their proper historical perspective. During the last 3 decades, we as a nation have been in the process of the greatest revolution in history. The aims of this revolution are to transform from a loosely sprawling empire into a close-knit national unit, from an autocracy of several thousand years standing into a democratic and representative government, from an ancient agrarian culture into a modern industrial and a scientific culture, from a people, the majority of whom are illiterate, into a nation of 450 million intelligent citizens and readers. You may think I have said a mouthful in saying all this, but I trust that you understand why these aims cannot have been accomplished in a few years. The birth of a new nation is painful. Historical processes are slow and uneven. Judged in the light of history, China has indeed, in our opinion, made more progress in the past 30 years than she ever did in the previous 3 centuries. Today, despite political differences, which exist as a matter of fact in every land, the Chinese people are more united than ever before. Despite the exigencies of the war, the voice of the people is stronger and more articulate than ever before. Despite the lack of books and pens, some 70 million more people have learned to read and write during these war years. I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, from this war, China will emerge a nation, a modern, unified, strong, and democratic nation. There may be forces that will now and then retard, but there are no forces that can permanently arrest this great national movement in our history. China has been the first victim of aggression, so rightly referred to in the introductory remarks of your distinguished chairman. It was in 1937, when Japan invaded Manchuria, that the Second War actually started. The League of Nations then was too weak to put into effect any measure that could stop Japan's aggression. Not satisfied with the occupation of Manchuria, Japan launched in 1937 a huge military campaign to conquer the whole of China. It was then that China decided to resist Japan to the bitter end, regardless of human cost and a material sacrifice. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, before Pearl Harbor, before December 7th, 1941, the day that will always live in infamy, the Chinese, poorly trained, poorly equipped, poorly fed and clothed, had fought against a first-class aggressor power for 4.5 years single-handed. They had lost many battles. They had lost many lives and many cities. But they never had lost their faith in their cause. Never for a moment had they ever thought of a negotiated peace with the enemy or of a conditional surrender by him. Even after Pearl Harbor, we had to fight alone. We adhered to the overall strategy of defeat Hitler first, knowing well that pending the collapse of Nazi Germany, we had to fight more or less alone. The last 2 years have been the hardest and most critical years of the war for us. Though your magnificent forces have fought and are still fighting splendidly on land, on the sea, and in the air of the vast Pacific Ocean. Now, happily, the would-be German Empire, which was to last 1,000 years, has fallen, and the Burma Road has reopened. The United States will be able immediately to rush aid to us. The next few months will see the decisive campaign on the continent of Asia. I can assure you that in the coming Battle of China, as in the recent Battle of Burma, the Chens and the Wangs, the Wus and the Lees in the Chinese army will prove themselves to be the worthy comrades of the American GIs and British Tommies. While we now rejoice over the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany, let us remember that our common task is but half done. As long as the makers of the Marco Polo Bridge incident and the perpetrators of the Pearl Harbor treachery are still at large, let our motto be on to Tokyo. For 3 weeks now, the delegates of 49 United Nations have been meeting in this city. They have devoted themselves to the writing of a charter of the United Nations. The government of the Republic of China has sent a representative delegation to this conference. The composition of the Chinese delegation is something unique in our history. Of the 10 delegates, 4 are members of the national government, 3 are representatives of the minority parties, and 3 are independent educational and social leaders. The delegation, our delegation, just as yours, represents many shades of opinion and different walks of life. The Chinese delegation came to the conference with 2 objectives. On the one hand, we hope to contribute our part in setting up a machinery through which peace and security may be maintained. On the other hand, we desire to cooperate with the other members of the United Nations in promoting the welfare of the peoples in the world and in establishing the rule of law in international relations. The maintenance of peace and security, or the prevention of war, is our first objective. In a sense, however, the maintenance of peace and security is not an end in itself, but a necessary condition under which the welfare of all peoples may be improved and the rule of law may be firmly established. So our second objective is really our ultimate objective. So in all our deliberations, in all our proposals and amendments and observations at the conference, we of the Chinese delegation are guided by these 2 objectives. Under the Dumbarton Oaks Plan, the Security Council is charged with the primary responsibility for the maintenance of peace and security. It alone is empowered to determine the existence of any threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and to decide upon measures to be taken to maintain or restore peace and security. Although this concept of the Security Council is not original with us, we have heartily endorsed it. We think that a clear-cut division of functions and powers between the Security Council and the General Assembly is a great improvement over the arrangements under the Covenant of the League of Nations. Under the Covenant, both the Council and the Assembly had power to deal with any matter within the sphere of action of the League or affecting the peace of the world. In other words, the powers were divided and the functions were not clearly defined. As a result, neither organ was primarily responsible for the maintenance of peace and security. And our appeal for the enforcement of the covenant and the application of a prompt check to the Japanese aggression went unheeded, so far as any effective action was concerned. Our case was shuffled back and forth between the Council and the Assembly, and the Chinese and the whole League saw the aggressor marching triumphantly forward from city to city, from province to province, in pursuit of his sinister design of domination and conquest. Now, by giving all the major powers in the new security organization a decisive voice in taking decisions for action, we have fixed a predominant responsibility on them, and it would no longer be possible for any of the major powers to hesitate and look anxiously for support from outside. From the experience of the so-called Manchurian incident, we have learned a significant lesson. That is, if international peace are to be maintained effectively, there should be an organ, one powerful organ, which is authorized and empowered to take necessary diplomatic, economic, and military measures to remove any threat to the peace or check any act of aggression. An organ in which all the major powers sit and have a definite responsibility to preserve peace and stop aggression. Furthermore, both the Council and the Assembly of the League were paralyzed by the rule of unanimity. No action could be taken unless it received a unanimous affirmative vote. Under the Dumbarton Oaks Plan, the Security Council, consisting of 5 permanent members and 6 non-permanent members, may take any action to maintain or restore peace and security by an affirmative vote of 7 members, including the concurrent votes of the permanent members. This, in our opinion, is a far more workable and effective procedure than that under the Covenant of the League of Nations. Therefore, we of China have gladly collaborated with the 3 other sponsoring powers as regards the Dumbarton Oaks Plan, and have been pleading at this conference for giving the new United Nations organization a chance to prove its ability to maintain peace and security. In fact, it will perhaps be a last chance of mankind to save itself from utter destruction. While we are one of the sponsoring nations of the Dumbarton Oaks Plan, we have, after careful study and consideration, made certain new proposals and amendments. Thus, during the Chinese phase of the Dumbarton Oaks conversations last year, we presented 3 proposals, which later received endorsement from the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union. The first of these proposals is that the Charter should provide specifically that adjustment or settlement of international disputes should be achieved with due regard for the principles of justice and international law. You will see, ladies and gentlemen, that while it is true that justice cannot be specifically and concretely defined, it is nevertheless the conscience of humanity, the inner voice of mankind, which expresses itself quietly, yet persistently and universally. Another Chinese proposal accepted by the sponsoring nations is that the Assembly should be responsible for initiating studies and making recommendations with reference to the development and revision of the rules of international law. For we believe that as the intercourse between peoples grow in complexity and the common interests of nations multiply and become more varied, principles and rules of conduct for their guidance need elucidation, revision, and supplementation. We think, therefore, that the General Assembly should from time to time initiate studies and make recommendations with respect to the development and revision of international law in order to diminish the uncertainties of the legal system between nations and supply the deficiencies of existing international law. If the United States organization is to maintain peace and security, we must, in the words of your distinguished veteran statesman, Mr. Cordell Hull, revitalize and strengthen international law. It is our conviction that peace cannot be maintained by power alone, and that peace can long endure only under the rule of law. The third proposal we made is that the Economic and Social Council should specifically provide for the promotion of educational and other forms of cultural cooperation. Here, this proposal, I hope, hardly needs any explanation. We think that we all agree that in the long run, international peace depends upon international understanding. One of the best means to promote such understanding is through cultural and educational cooperation. The Social and Economic Council should therefore consider the duty to promote the exchange of professors, the exchange of literature, scientific knowledge, and social and political information so that people of the world may better understand one another. You will see that these three proposals provide the moral basis of the new international charter, and we, on our part, feel convinced that it is only through a clear recognition of these ideals that the world may be made happy and contented. Our approach to the task of drafting a charter for the World Security Organization is guided solely by the consideration of what is most needed, as well as what is practicable in the post-war world. It is the promotion of the cause of peace, justice, and happiness which is uppermost in our mind. Thus, as regards regional arrangements, the view of the Chinese delegation is this, that while regional arrangements are useful and appropriate instruments for maintaining regional peace and security, they should recognize the paramount authority and responsibility of the Security Council in all enforcement action. We must avoid any arrangements that would tend to weaken the world organization on the one hand and to form regional power blocks on the other. Our final aim must be to have a world organization that can win the confidence of all regional agencies and that can direct and utilize all such agencies in the maintenance of international peace and security. Again, in respect of setting up a system of territorial trusteeship, we attach great importance to its character and its objectives. It should be regarded as a sacred trust, not only by the administering country, but also by the whole world organization. It should not be confined to administration by individual nations alone, but also directly by the world organization through its own agencies. In other words, that international administration of territories which may be placed under the trusteeship system should not be excluded from the scope and the purview of our charter. Also, among the basic objectives, we would like to see included independence as well as self-government for the peoples of the territories that may come under the administration of the trusteeship system. Only thus, we believe, can we give hope to millions and tens of millions of people who aspire now or who will soon aspire to political freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, I have tried to give you here an idea of China's purpose and policy at the conference, as well as her plan and program of internal reconstruction and development. These two problems are, in fact, closely interrelated. The success of the conference in writing the fundamental charter of a new world organization to maintain peace and security and to promote the welfare of the community of nations will be a help to China in her work of building a modern state, modern in every aspect. It will be a help because China hopes it will relieve her of anxiety about possible difficulties in the future in her international relations. This freedom from fear about her own security will guarantee her an opportunity to devote her attention and thought and energy to the work of rebuilding and rehabilitation. On the other hand, the emergence of a united, independent, strong, and prosperous China will be a great stabilizing factor in the Far East and in the Pacific, and will therefore be a valuable asset in our common task and purpose to check and forestall aggression and preserve peace in the world, so that peace-loving peoples everywhere will not be called upon again to send their sons to fight and die in battle. China and the United States, facing each other across the broad expanse of the Pacific Ocean, different as their institutions, customs, and manners are united, as always, in many ideals. The most outstanding of these common ideals is the passionate desire for peace and for the establishment in the relations between nations as between citizens of the rule of law and justice over force and violence. So when the noble purpose of the San Francisco Conference of rearing an edifice of international welfare and security is attained, and a new and powerful China has emerged, the world will see the presence of two essential factors in the building of a global peace, a peace which will last and which will be everlasting.